Well, that was a fascinating hour with Richard C. Hoagland and Ken Johnston, especially when Ken started talking about some of those anomalies on the moon and Mars. Richard, that's probably time for another program. We'll be back with Richard C. Hoagland. He'll give us another shuttle update. And also Tim Ventura is joining us as we talk about anti-gravity, new propulsion systems right here on Coast to Coast AM. And before we bring in Tim Ventura, Richard C., want to give us another shuttle Discovery update?
Well, Discovery is over the Atlantic, about 224 miles. It just entered its 201st sunrise. Can you imagine having a sunrise and sunset every 45 minutes, George?
Oh, amazing.
and they're gorgeous. They're incredibly gorgeous. You know, watching them on television obviously doesn't do justice to what you'd really see. And it all happens in just seconds as the sun disappears or reappears. Anyway, they're pressing through their checklist, and the mission control people are looking at this weather situation very carefully. It appears to be, unfortunately, deteriorating, meaning that with these clouds, in addition to the rain, the droplets in the clouds, Eileen cannot see the runway when she comes down from orbit.
Okay.
And it's a glider, remember, and she's got to see that runway because the last 3 minutes, it's under her, you know, personal control.
It's bad enough it's at night.
Well, night again increases the signal to noise with all the floodlights if you got clear weather. But apparently they may not have clear weather for this first opportunity. And so in another 10 minutes or so, we're going to get the go, no go. And we'll know at about that time whether we're go for a landing on the first pass tonight.
Okay, but they have not made a decision
at
that
yet.
Point. Okay.
That is coming up.
Tim Ventura started doing independent research into anti-gravity in 1992, but didn't begin sharing his work with the public, with us, until 2002. He created the American Anti-Gravity website in 2002 when he became involved with the Lifter Project, popularized by Jean-Louis Naudin on the JLN Labs website in France. American Anti-Gravity has done considerable research since that time into a variety of anti-gravity and field effect propulsion projects. The American Anti-Gravity website has become the most comprehensive resource of its kind online and has evolved since its inception into a one-stop resource for news and information about anti-gravity technology. In addition, Tim's American Anti-Gravity website has been featured on a multitude of television networks such as Nippon Television in Japan and the BBC, as well as extensively covered in print by sources as diverse as Wired Magazine and Jane's Defense Weekly. Our guest tonight this hour with Richard C. Hoagland, Tim Ventura. Tim, welcome back to Coast to Coast.
Well, thanks for having me on, George. It's always a pleasure to do the show with yourself and Richard. You know, you guys are both old pros at this. And so
hi, Tim.
Kind of like the odd man out.
Hey, Tim, since we last talked, anything new in the field of anti-gravity?
Absolutely. In fact, there's so much that I was just sitting here with a big sheath of papers trying to figure out which things to present first. If it's okay, I could run through some of the news.
Yeah, give us the highlights of what's been going on.
Well, I guess the first and foremost thing has been, you know, as you know, Richard has the new blog on Enterprise Mission.
Yes.
And that was kind of an inspiration for us to go to a new content management system. So I undertook the task of rebuilding American Anti-Gravity, and so we currently have two websites, actually. It's a little bit painful for the time being, but it's a transition process. So it's still AmericanAntiGravity.com, and we have a whole new look and feel. And what we're trying to do is really focus on the community values for anti-gravity and breakthrough propulsion, focusing on the authors and the inventors and the real genius that resides within the American public, instead of focusing just solely on the technology. So it's kind of a shift. It's more of an author-driven site.
All right.
But we're able to really showcase, I guess, each individual path of research and hopefully correlate them together.
You know, the reason, George, I wanted to do this show, your first Sunday night show, by the way, congratulations.
Well, in a long time.
In a long time, yes. The reason I wanted to do it and bring all these threads together on the night that Discovery is coming home is because if you remember watching 2001, remember that incredible idea that by 2001 we'd have orbiting Hiltons and bases on the moon and flights to the moons of Jupiter and access to space would be so cheap that anybody could go? Where did that all go?
Tell us more, Dave.
Why are we still stuck with this aging, crippling shuttle 1960s type technology.
Old propulsion.
Well, now, you know, it's more than just the propulsion, though. One of the things that I used to work in telecom at AT&T Wireless and, as well as other companies. One of the things that I found was the computer systems for this also tend to be incredibly antiquated. Now, there was a rumor that the astronauts, way back when, were actually taking up 46 laptops with them to help compute trajectories. So I think that it's far more than just the actual nuts and bolts itself. I think it goes to the very core of the design and the systems integration. In the telecom industry, people are almost afraid to touch some of the older equipment. It's almost like if you take the duct tape off it, you might not be able to put it back on. And I suspect that the computer systems, while they are stable and solid in the shuttle, it becomes harder and harder with each passing year.
But Tim and Richard, I mean, if there is no anti-gravity possibilities in the next, few years? How long is it going to take to do
not
this?
Not true. That's the myth we want to blow away tonight.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
yes.
quite the contrary. There are so much, there's such a diversity of research out there. And, not
and engineering, not just research, not just theory, but actual hardware.
Yeah, it's really quite remarkable. Well, one of the stories that I've been working on this week, if I could run through them really quick,
yep.
On our new website, again, at AmericanAntiGravity.com.
Do it fast.
The first one is I'm doing a story on Chukanov Energy. That's C-H-U-K, I believe it's A-N-O-V, energy.com. And that's kind of interesting because the research involves ball lightning. And so it's kind of related to, it was presented at this Tesla Tech 2005 conference that I just attended. It was a wonderful conference. And they kind of reopened this idea of gas plasmas. And this is something that we've been seeing more and more rumors and research regarding in the anti-gravity community. And then here we are seeing it presumably for use in the free energy community as well. And they were talking about, the fellow's name is Dr. Kirill Chukanov, and he's a Russian immigrant scientist, originally from Bulgaria. And he's talking about 500% efficiency in something that almost looks like one of the old Farnsworth fusers. So I thought it was really interesting to see yet another tie-in to some of these emerging technologies. So that's definitely one of the stories up there.
All right.
I also put up a return to flight story, which is just a little bit of background information, for the show, I guess. Tom Vallone, I actually have it right in front of me, just published a new book called Electrogravitics 2.
What the heck is that?
Well, he's kind of resurrecting the B-field Brown technology. And, as you know, this is probably...
Tim, we might want to go to mission control.
All right, okay. Up it comes.
...is no-go, and the forecast continues to be no-go with the broken layer at 1,000. Essentially, the one word that describes the situation right now is unstable. The STA is going to land and refuel, and we're going to look at the next rev, the official forecast for the next rev, as far as cloud layers go, is still go. There's still a chance of showers in there, but we think that we can pull that out after a bit.
All right,
so
Richard.
All that being said, you can flip the entry checklist over to page 6.
Richard, next rev then, they're talking about 6:21 a.m. Eastern time. Is that right?
Yeah, 90 minutes. Everything shifts 90 minutes, so we will not have a landing during the show. But they're playing it really safe, and I'm very glad.
Okay, now, if they cancel that, will they consider Edwards?
Edwards will be tomorrow.
Would be tomorrow.
Would be tomorrow.
They would not go back to Florida then.
No, they will not go back to Florida. If they miss tonight, the next opportunity will be Edwards tomorrow night.
And they'll just shoot right in for that.
During your show.
Okay, very good. Man, it just goes on, doesn't it?
Yep.
Well,
fortunately, they do have the consumables to stay up there.
I'm sure these astronauts have got to be frustrated by now.
Well, some of them are, some of them aren't. I mean, remember, we have rookies on board who've never done this, so if they can stay in space a day longer, that's cool. In fact, given that they'd be basically waiting for the weather and the orbit opportunities, it'll be a very light day tomorrow if they do have to wait, and they would have more chance for sightseeing.
Okay.
Nothing wrong with the ship. The ship is operating in perfect condition.
Everything's fine there.
The only concern is these tiles.
Mother Nature, too.
And Mother Nature.
All right. Well, you just heard it with Richard C. Hoagland and NASA's audio. They have canceled the first run to land, which would have been 4:46 a.m. Eastern time. They are now going to shoot for 6:21 a.m. Eastern time, if that works. If not, then as Richard said, they will plan a landing tomorrow. When you say tomorrow, Richard, are you talking about Tuesday or late Monday?
No, it's Tuesday.
Tuesday morning.
It shifts 24 hours.
All right, Edwards Air Force Base in California.
North of you.
Where the weather here has been clear and fine, so they should have no problem with that at all. Tim, let's go back to you now. If you would, you were talking about this latest technology about anti-gravity.
Oh, sure. Well, I already, again, I ran through the Chukunov energy story, which is just kind of a personal story I've been working on. And then Tom Vallone just published Electrogravitics 2. And the thing that I thought was incredibly interesting about that was he claims to have found definitive evidence to demonstrate that the Biefeld-Brown effect, under certain conditions, is a true form of inertialess propulsion. And that actually takes it back to square one in terms of the argument, because NASA had really written it off and said, you know, this really isn't. And so it's interesting to see this idea resurrected yet again, I guess. Now, one of the things that I've done, I guess, on the website has kind of move on. And, you know, we've built the lifters. We've built them up to 4 feet. Well, actually, I had a 9-foot one in size that lifted off and flew. And one of the things that I've tried to do is migrate from Biefeld-Brown technologies to, hopefully, some of these larger-scale, more powerful technologies. Again, the gas plasmas come back into that. And strangely enough, it seems like we're almost integrating back into some of these UFO stories. You know, I started a story on Eugene Poglanoff's work, and again, he has a new force beam claim. And I kind of went from that and kind of moved forward to a variety of different other stories, and it brought me back to Mark McCandlish and Edgar Fouché and this mercury gas plasma toroid technology. So, you know, it's bending space. That's what it's
now,
all about.
But it sounds like, Tim, we're talking about different kinds of technology for anti-gravity. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it's the same effect. I think that's what all of these, you know, anecdotes and research, because there's a lot of hard research out there. One of the things that we are finding, and this has been just amazing, we actually have a number of government contacts coming forward. And I think that they're just kind of getting fed up with the lack of progress that's been made in science. Again, there's a stigma associated with these technologies. Free energy is in the same boat.
I was told that Boeing was working on anti-gravity technology at a furious pace. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, my understanding was Boeing actually had some internal squabbles about it and dropped the project.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm not sure how far they got. I know for sure that they at least had a document floating around internally. Somebody forwarded me a copy of it a while back. But I'm not sure if they actually made it to the construction or testing phase. And the claim was, and I think this shows how counterintuitive kind of the management perspective on these things are, they decided not to go with anti-gravity on an upper management level. Supposedly this was like the president's office, you know, in 2002 of Boeing, that is. There was some kind of a memo saying, we don't want you to research anti-gravity. It's kind of quacky. We're not really sure how solid this technology is. We want people to think of Boeing as being stable and reliable, you know, and in 2001, in 2002, we were still recovering as a country emotionally from September 11th.
Yes.
I think in many ways we still are.
Still are, absolutely.
And so I can see Boeing's perspective back then, and it seems to be changing. And this is something that Richard and I have talked about to no end, because it's really quite amazing. But again, what we're seeing are scientists and engineers and, more recently, managers and officers, literally just boiling out of the government and defense contractors and major industries, and they have the same stories and the same anecdotes from completely different places, and they have tons and tons of research, and all of this is starting to finally come forward.
Do you have any doubts, Tim, that eventually, let's not put a date on it yet, but eventually we will have anti-gravity technology for commercial airlines, for maybe cars, who knows what?
You know, the part that is mind-blowing to me is I never doubted for a second that we would have anti-gravity technology. You know, again, we have, 70 or 80 years worth of stories and research that tell us that it's possible. You know, government reports, you know, even in the deep, dark days of the Cold War, we had reports telling us that it was possible. But the thing that's been really surprising is the mainstream support. I guess I started out with this in kind of the fight to power mode, right? You know, you start out being rebellious and say, well, you know, to heck with the system. We want to do it our way. We're going to do it different, and we're going to, you know, overthrow convention. And as it turns out, I guess, you know, as the children of the 60s realized, if you fight hard enough against the establishment, you end up becoming
okay. But my question was, do you see this being used in all kinds of practical ways, like commercial airlines and things?
Absolutely. I think commercial airlines would greatly benefit from this. Again, our aircraft fleets, our shuttle fleet, our roadways, these are all becoming antiquated systems. The problem wasn't that they didn't work. The problem was that they worked well enough that we overcrowded them, you know. Living in Seattle, I used to commute across the 520 bridge. Anyone living in Seattle can probably tell you about this. A 15-mile drive might take two and a half hours.
Oh, welcome to Los Angeles, Tim.
Yeah.
Richard C., look into your crystal ball. What kind
of... I'm just laughing because our worst traffic jam in Albuquerque is 10 minutes. That's a really bad day.
Yeah, I
Friday,
know
Friday, 5 o'clock,
I
10
know
minutes.
It. Hey, you know what? Count your chickens, my friend.
That's why I'm here, George. Not there and not up in Seattle, Tim.
Well, look into your crystal ball, Richard. What applications for anti-gravity? What do you see
oh
in the future?
Oh, my God. To coin a phrase, the sky is not the limit. But let me give you a real forecast, and then after the break we can get into some specifics.
All right.
I believe the way the politics of this are flowing, that the reason that Tim is getting a lot of inside people talking to him and talking on the record is because they realize that officially, per government, it will never come to pass. If we're going to have anti-gravity, we're going to have real space flight, we're going to have access to the moon and Mars and colonies and all the stuff you saw in 2001,
private.
It's going to have to be a private initiative.
Yeah.
It's going to have to be led by, you know, to people like Tim, the Anti-Gravity Foundation, and he will get into what he wants to do later on tonight. But it's going to have to be the good old American private enterprise, pun intended, because I think the kibosh was put on this officially at the government level back in the 1950s. And I can give you specifics having to do with a certain Air Force conference that was held in North Carolina in the fall of 1958. And before that conference, there was all kinds of really bubbly, newsy kind of, you know, pronouncements by magazines, by Colliers, by Popular Science, by the captains of industry, the head of General Dynamics, and Martin Marietta. Well, it wasn't Marietta, there was just the Martin Company. All these corporations that were absolutely bursting at the seams with the idea that their experiments would lead to anti-gravity control in 5 years. And then in 1958, George, it all went black. It was like you cut it off with a switch. I remember being back at the Museum of Science in Springfield, Massachusetts, back in the early years of the 60s, and seeing a couple of articles in Missiles and Rockets, which was the kind of aerospace Bible then, taken over by Aviation Week now, and then it all disappeared. Like, nobody would talk about it, nobody would mention it, it wasn't at conferences, it wasn't funded, it just disappeared. And if you know anything about the way the black ops guys work, when it disappears from public discussion is when it becomes serious.
That's
behind the scenes.
Exactly. Do either one of you believe that any of this technology might have come from ancient technology on this planet?
You know, let me leap in here, Tim, and take the brunt of this.
Absolutely.
And you know where I'm headed with this, Richard.
The question is no, and I don't give a damn. I think our attention has been so preoccupied with, ooh, aliens, ooh, hidden technology, we have missed the fact that good old human beings, going back to, you know, Townsend Brown, figured out how to do this decades ago. And I think all the UFO stuff has been cute disinformation, because if you link it to UFOs, real scientists, real physicists, real engineers will not get interested.
But you're not saying UFOs aren't happening, are you?
I don't know. I really, but see, I know enough of what we've done on Earth ourselves that we don't need aliens to show us how to do it, or we don't need to back engineer fallen craft.
If I could interject for
absolutely.
Just a sec.
Tim, why don't you hold it until the break, okay? And then we'll get back to you. Tim's website is AmericanAntiGravity.com. Richard's, of course, is EnterpriseMission.com. He writes a regular blog now and updates that quite often at EnterpriseMission.com. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Well, I was pondering maybe we should just hang around for two more hours after we normally go off and monitor the shuttle, but we can't do that because we run into the station's morning shows, and hence we wouldn't be on the air there. So it's a moot point. By the way, Great time to say hello to all of you listening on your favorite radio stations across the country and in Canada. Streamlink members, of course, hello to you, the fantastic Forum Pirates. A brand new chat room that has opened up. Those of you who like to participate in that and chat while the show is on the air, it's called NighthawkZone.com. NighthawkZone.com. The Imaginative Worlds Explorers, hello to you. National Radio Club, Pal Talk, Sorcery, IRC. The list just continues to grow and grow. People all around the country and the world chatting back and forth, reacting to the program and things that they're hearing, especially things like Prophet Yahweh, who today has decided that he is going to go to every state in this country, in the United States, and try to summon up UFOs. So he's starting on Sunday. I don't know where he went. I don't know where he is, as a matter of fact, but Prophet Yahweh well on his way to trying to get UFOs to appear now in every state in the United States. All 50 of them. His campaign began today. How about that? I'll be back in a moment. We'll continue chatting with Tim Ventura, Richard C. Hoagland on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Tim Ventura, Richard C. Hoagland. Tim, you were chiming in there before the break.
Absolutely. Well, actually, I was just going to support Richard's comment. You know, Richard, I think, is the original space activist. And, you know, he's spoken at length about getting the name changed for the original shuttle to Enterprise. And I think that, in my own personal opinion at least, I think space activism will be the new environmentalism for the 21st century. And the reason that that, I think, reflects back on some of the ancient culture myths as well as kind of the UFO myth are really some of the emails that I've received. You know, and people are well-intentioned. I mean, you know, they have the best intent when they send the emails. But I get a lot of emails saying, you know, the government already has this or ET already has this. Why don't we just ask them or force them or, you know, find some way to get them to give this to us? And I think it goes back to, again, what Richard does on a day-to-day basis and has been doing for decades now, which is taking responsibility for making the future happen. You know, it really comes back to, well, for instance, with environmentalism in the 60s. I think the environmental movement back then wouldn't have gone anywhere if it had been based on asking someone to do something. You know, it really became about taking on the personal responsibility to make sure that, you know, our products were safer and healthier, that, you know, companies weren't allowed to get away with polluting and things like that, and had a tremendous impact. And now our world is, you know, a much better place to live as a result. And so I think we can do the same thing with space activism. And it's not just about Star Trek stuff. It's about solutions right here at home. Again, for transportation issues, you know, the computer guidance systems are already in place for the commuter sky car. The Molar Sky Car Company actually has an atmospheric version of this. It's a, you know, uses 6 VTOL engines to lift off and fly. Now, it has some issues because it's, you know, gasoline-based, and so it's a little bit older technology. But it really demonstrates that we have all the parts in place except these systems, the anti-gravity systems. And those already exist. The trick is understanding them well enough to do something.
Well, now tell me, Tim, what scientists are out there right now in mass working on anti-gravity propulsion systems?
You know, they're too numerous to mention.
Are they all fragmented?
Well, Paul Larch and Jim Woodward have been working. They actually just had some really amazing results on a MOX principal thruster.
Who's financing these people?
You know, it's all self-financed. And I think that actually that goes to the heart of kind of the next part. And again, Richard had mentioned this in the last segment. One of the ideas is trying to bring it all together in a nonprofit foundation. And that's what American Anti-Gravity has really been all about.
Why don't we have like an XPRIZE for propulsion like this? You know, we were able to get someone into space privately.
Well, you know, it was kind of weird because during the XPRIZE, you know, which was won by Burt Rutan and his Spaceship One concept, the concept of an anti-gravity system entering in that race and winning the money was specifically excluded by the founders of the prize. I mean, talk about being ostriches and having your head stuck in the ground. I mean, these are people who love rockets, who love going up on a controlled explosion where when the slightest thing goes wrong, you're history or toast or whichever metaphor you like. I mean, anti-gravity is so much safer Because for one thing, you never have to deal with incredible speeds. You know, you could basically get into orbit moving at the pace of the little old lady from Pasadena who wears tennis sneakers. You don't have to accelerate 17,500 miles per hour in the atmosphere. Yeah. Now, to be in orbit, you got to do that. But what you do is you would go straight up like an elevator. And then when you got above the sensible atmosphere where you didn't need heat protection or aerodynamics or wings or fins or rudders, you'd basically move sideways until you were moving fast enough that you could turn off the engine and coast because you'd be in orbit. I mean, anti-gravity, true control of inertia and gravity, changes everything. I mean everything, from going to work, commuting, to the price of everything we buy at Home Depot or in the supermarkets. You asked me before the break, you know, what the implications were?
Yes.
There are no limits. Think of everything we do now at the price of fuel and tires or wings or jet engines or cables, and think of it being replaced with a little modular engine that basically runs on electricity, and you flip a switch, and there's a little hum, and whatever it's contained in goes gravity neutral, and you basically have to tie it down, and when you turn the switch off or turn the potentiometer down, the hum goes down, the weight gradually returns, and it sits back down on its cradle or on its wheels or whatever. Think, for instance, of all the stuff we ship from the other side of the world, you know, bulk goods, huge things that require ocean-going vessels and tons of oil to drive them halfway around the planet, or if they're in very on a short time constraint, they have to be put on a 747 or a Galaxy, you know, aircraft or whatever to fly around the planet. Think of the amount of energy we would save if we simply had control of gravity and you could float these things around the world basically at the push of a finger.
Speaking of floating, Richard, I'm looking at a picture from Discovery of the planet as it slowly goes around the
Actually,
Earth.
That's not.
What is that?
That is from the space station.
The one we're looking at right now?
Yep, that's okay. A live shot from the International Space Station. The reason that it isn't from Discovery is Discovery has all its cameras in the payload bay, and when they close those payload bay doors, the cameras can't see out.
Yeah, I don't have audio, so I'm just looking at a picture. And let me tell you, it is absolutely beautiful.
The Earth, wouldn't you love to be able to go up and have dinner? Or take your best gal up for a sunset,
that would be
sunrise.
Revolving dinner place, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's the ultimate revolving dinner place. And what's really the crime here is that we've had the science and the engineering outlines of how to do this for at least the last half century, if not longer. And I will say categorically, the only reason that we're having this discussion tonight on the air about wouldn't it be nice if, is because the military, the DOD, national security, black ops stepped in and made all of this as if it had never existed, and that's why we're risking these brave people in a spacecraft that's out of the Stone Age.
When I first got my exposure to you, it was when I saw on a cable channel at night you talking about the monuments of Mars, and I was fascinated by it. Then I stumbled into you with Art years later. Today, you're talking about, you know, real science. You've kind of shied away from
you. I've always been talking about
Hold on now. Hold on. Hold on.
Aware that it was real science.
Hold on.
Recently.
Hold on. But you're shying away from UFOs, okay?
Well, I've never been a UFO guy.
That's what I'm saying. So how can you be such a proponent of, for example, monuments of Mars, strange anomalies on the moon, things going around the moons of Saturn, and not believe or be a proponent of UFOs?
No, it's not a matter of belief. It's a matter of I can't do any useful work. I mean, you've had more people come on this show and Art before you talk about UFOs, sightings, landings, conspiracies, theories, et cetera, et cetera. And where are we?
Still talking about landings, conspiracies, sightings.
Yeah. There has been no progress in the UFO field in the last 50 years. Whereas in the field of exoarchaeology, we've got some incredible pictures and better pictures all the time of things on the moon and on Mars and other places in the solar system.
What are you saying, though?
That are leaking out of this space agency, this only civilian space agency we've got. For better or worse, I love NASA.
Are you saying, though, all these ufologists are off base here?
No, I'm saying they're limited by their source of data. In other words, when you put the skullduggery, whoever is flying these vehicles around, alongside the skullduggery of whatever government operations are trying to keep people from taking seriously the people who are flying vehicles around, you're basically at square one. You'll never make progress.
You know, one of the things that I'd like to touch on also is whatever conspiracy may be at work here, what I am finding is, and Richard can certainly vouch for this, we've made some pretty good contacts over the last couple of years. And I think we're moving up higher and higher, right? The government insider approach, you know, and one of the things we're finding is you get up to pretty high-ranking levels. And the people that I am talking to and the people that Richard is talking to some degree, they don't know. They don't have the answers. And they're in the positions where they should have the answers. And so if the conspiracy is out there, which I've been a Coast fan since 92 myself, mm-hmm. so I've heard, you know, just about every story out there, and they all seem credible. But the problem becomes, why don't the people who should know about it know about it?
Let me give you a stunning example, which I was talking with Tim about just a few hours ago.
All right.
You were obviously a little busy the other night when they did the undocking on Friday night.
I was very busy.
And I always had the luxury of sitting here with, you know, one ear listening to you and one ear to Mission Control and NASA television on my big screen and with tape running. When they undocked, they saw something on the TV that looked like a UFO. And Eileen Collins called down even as they were backing the spacecraft away from the station and flying around to take those shots of the top of it at a piece of equipment they were concerned about. And she said, and I'm going to paraphrase, did you guys see that thing that appeared when we undocked? And I watched the footage that was shot in Mission Control of the capsule communicator, the astronaut that's charged with communicating up to the spacecraft,
yeah.
and the flight director. And you could see, they didn't have sound, but you could actually see them deciding in front of a television camera to lie to Eileen Collins. Because what they said to her was, well, Eileen, we saw that, but it was just a reflection. We decided it's just a reflection. And they said, did you see anything out the window? She says, no, we saw it on TV, you know, on the uplink, like you did. We were wondering what you thought it was. And they said, oh, it was just a reflection. And the flight director gave a reason why he thought it was. Later that night on the blog, I got an anonymous tip from a guy who works at NASA, who basically said, go back and look at the tape frame by frame. That was not a piece of debris. It was not a reflection. It was a real unidentified object hovering in the background looking at the undocking of the Discovery from the space station.
That's dramatic
now,
stuff.
Now, I have looked at my film, and I, even before this came in, I was totally in agreement. It was not a reflection, and it was not debris. And then you got to ask yourself, well, if Eileen Collins, commander of this space shuttle mission, in training for this mission for 4 years with her crew of six, is spooked enough when she sees something on television to call down and ask, that means she's not in the loop as to what she might be seeing, right?
I agree with that.
In other words, she was giving an honest, what the heck is that? And they either were wink, wink, nod, nod, you know, we'll tell you when you get on the ground, Eileen,
yeah.
or they themselves did not know and dismissed it. So the level of denial about UFOs is so incredibly deep in our society that even when you've got proof recorded on data of something that's anomalous, the inclination is to just kind of wish it would go away.
Well, Tim Ventura, what role might this be for someone like you who is trying to assemble all this information about anti-gravity? I mean, where are you going to be at 5, 10, 15 years from now?
Well, I'm hoping that we'll be in space, actually. And I think the reason behind that is one of the things that we're finding is the people who are publishing real credible papers are starting to come out of the woodwork. A good place to look is the STAFE conference, and we have a ton of material on that. That's Space Technology Access International Forum. We have material and links on that on AmericanAntiGravity.com, and we're adding more because we're still, you know, again, it's the new website. We're still backloading information. And again, the people publishing on this are not necessarily independent inventors. We have tons of indie inventors writing wonderful papers. We also have Lockheed engineers, Boeing engineers, military scientists from pretty much every branch out there. You know, I mean, people from every group that work in the aerospace community are writing papers on their off time. They're not getting paid for it, and they're really not getting much recognition for it. And what we just started seeing is in the last 2 years, these papers are beginning to become accepted in journals, although people still kind of sneer at them. So we're seeing a little bit more acceptance there. But what we're also seeing is these people are coming together through the internet and through American Anti-Gravity. And so what we're doing is becoming a source for information. We're really trying to manage this open source effort. And it's not all indie inventors, although we love working with indie inventors because they have a creative passion that a lot of the professional engineers, you know, may have lost years ago. So we're trying to put that mixture together. And one of the things that Richard had touched on earlier was a conference. Now, I'd mentioned the STAFE conference, and that's an excellent venue, but it's also very formal. And one of the problems has been with these conferences, you know, somebody had told me a while ago, it was a PhD scientist, and they said, you know, nobody ever gets a real impression of what PhDs actually talk about because, you know, we'll go to these conferences and give really boring, stuffy presentations. Then we'll get together after hours, you know, when nobody's looking and talk about UFOs and time travel. So one of the ideas that we had, and I think it would be an incredibly valuable idea, is being able to get these guys together because right now, in this day and age, right, at this very moment, we have more experts alive and in great working form for gravity research than at any point in history. You know, we really have a dream team, and for the most part, they work together really well. They've learned, probably through their own tribulations, they've learned to have tolerance for other people's ideas. And so what we're literally trying to do is come up with a conference to put them in the same room and let them hash out some of these ideas. We did this with Hutchison. I did a joint interview with Hutchison and a fellow named Ted Gagan, who does homeopathy.
Is this technology expensive?
Well, the prototype for it usually is, unfortunately, although it may depend to a large degree how it's built exactly. Gas plasmas are going to be a pain to work with. Superconductors may be a little bit less expensive after they're, you know, perfected. It depends in large part on which path ends up being the most workable.
George, if I can jump in,
sure.
My bet is it won't be expensive. Heinlein used to have like three laws of engineering, that the first device is incredibly big and inefficient and incredibly expensive to operate. And then as you go through the refinement and the engineering and the science, it gets smaller and smaller and cheaper and cheaper.
It's like everything. Remember our cell phones?
Or remember the big computers that filled rooms, required the cooling power of Niagara Falls?
The old UNIVACs.
Yeah, and now you can literally hold one in your hand that has more computing power than every computer on Earth back then.
That's right.
So here's an interesting slant. When nuclear technology first raised its head and the idea to build a bomb, it was classified because they didn't want the off chance that somebody privately would basically figure out how to make a weapon and ultimately wind up some of the things you've been discussing the last couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Anti-gravity technology has never been classified officially. Think about that. Even though we know theoretically it should be possible, certainly we know from some of the engineering work that it is possible, and I know this because the late Gene Mayloff, my dear friend Gene Mayloff, reported personally to me seeing in Canada a functioning anti-gravity technology. We'll get into that later in the morning. The fact that it has never been officially classified, in other words, there's no law that you would break if you were to go to a conference and talk with guys about how to make an anti-gravity device,
mm-hmm.
is the clearest indication that the powers that be do not want us to even think it's possible.
I'll tell you a funny story when we come back about these devices, Richard, at a conference I was at. And also, we're going to open up the phone lines now, give you a chance to talk with Richard C. Hoagland and Tim Ventura about anti-gravity. You can also chat with Richard about the space shuttle if you like. It's your turn. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment this Monday morning on Coast to Coast AM.